First case on our calendar is 09-678, State of Ohio versus Joseph Pepka. Mr. Horacek.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I am Joshua Horacek, representing the State of Ohio from the office of Charles Colson, the Lake County Prosecuting Attorney. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal this morning. Your Honor, I'm here today to ask you to protect the sanctity of the grand jury process, uphold the previous decisions of this court, and reverse the 11th District Court of Appeals. This case presents the choice between two presumptions. I'm asking you to find that the plain reading of the indictment in this case sufficiently indicated the grand jury's intention to charge the defendant with 3 counts of endangering children as felonies of the third degree. The defendant, on the other hand, is asking you to presume that the grand jury had no idea what it was doing when it indicted Mr. Pepka on 3 counts of child endangering without including language of serious physical harm, yet while indicating that they were felonies of the third degree. I'd like to start this morning with my first proposition of law, which is an indictment that charges a defendant with endangering children in violation of RC 2919.22A as a felony of the third degree is sufficient, regardless of whether it indicates that the victim suffered serious physical harm. In this case, the defendant was charged under RC 2919.22A, which provides an operative section that indicates no person who is a parent or guardian or a custodian or having custody or control, et cetera, of a child under 18 years of age shall create a substantial risk to the health, safety, and child by violating a duty of care, protection, or support. A violation of this section typically constitutes a misdemeanor of the first degree. However, further on in the statute, in the penalty section, it provides that if a violation of this section results in serious physical harm to the child, the crime is a felony of the third degree. In this case, the indictment indicated that Mr. Pepka had violated Section A of 2919.22 and stood accused of a felony of the third degree. However, the indictment contained no language regarding serious physical harm. It is our contention, nonetheless, that this indictment was sufficient to charge Mr. Pepka with a felony of the third degree as opposed to the misdemeanor of the first degree.
Although the prosecutor did amend the indictment.
That is correct, Your Honor, which is why this case presents itself as an amendment issue. Prior to trial, the prosecutor realized that the indictment said nothing of serious physical harm and sought to clarify the indictment by adding the language of serious physical harm via amendment. At the time this was added, the defense attorney indicated that he knew all along that this was a serious physical harm case. So the indictment was amended, and I believe a week later, this case went to trial. The jury was obviously instructed on serious physical harm, and Mr. Pepka was convicted of 3 felonies of the third degree. The question arises under this court's longstanding cases, such as State v. O'Brien, as to when an amendment is proper. This court said that an indictment which does not contain all of the essential elements of an offense may be amended to include the omitted element if the name or identity of the crime is not changed and the accused has not been misled or prejudiced by the omission of such an element from the indictment. I don't believe that there is any contention in this case that the accused was misled. His defense attorney did say that he knew from the beginning that this was a felony of the third degree. So the issue arose whether or not the amendment, adding the language of serious physical harm, changed the degree of the offense from a misdemeanor of the first degree to a felony of the third degree. It is our position that the original indictment being sufficient to charge Mr. Pepka with a felony of the third degree, the amendment did not affect the degree of the offense.
Counsel, what is your response to the public defender's argument that the state and the Court of Appeals argued that the statutory language in question was a special finding, and that we should not consider it here.
With due respect to the public defender in this case, the state's primary argument at the Court of Appeals was based on the first proposition of law that the indictment was sufficient to charge Mr. Pepka with a felony of third degree, even without the language of serious physical harm. The issue of a special finding was more of a sub-argument and was presented most directly on a motion for reconsideration after this court released its reconsideration in the Smith case, which was released while the case was pending at the Court of Appeals. Hence, that's why we argued it via the motion for reconsideration. But our primary argument—
But in Smith, we said that a special finding should be, as a matter of due process, presented. And how do we know, looking at this record, that the grand jury considered serious physical harm?
Well, Your Honor, in Smith, I believe the analysis tracked the language of RC 2945.75 and said the special finding, had the case been presented to the grand jury as a theft case, due process would require that the indictment either state the degree of the offense or allege the amount in question for the theft. In this case, the indictment did state the degree of the offense.
You're relying on the degree of the offense, not the language of serious physical harm.
Yes, Your Honor. The indictment clearly stated that the defendant was being charged with a felony of the third degree.
What is your position with respect to the confusing opinions of the appellate court? Really, we have a bifurcated three-judge panel with three separate opinions, and at least arguably, one judge concurring that the matter should be remanded, but also concurring that the defendant's conviction for a felony of the third degree should be affirmed. How do you affirm a third degree felony conviction and remand for sentencing as a misdemeanor?
I believe that the concurrence, Judge O'Toole thought that as opposed to remanding the case,
Judge O'Toole wanted the matter dismissed.
Yeah, Judge O'Toole wanted the matter dismissed.
I believe another judge on the panel concurred in the result to affirm the judgment of the trial court, but then remand for sentencing.
Yes, Your Honor. Judge Rice did it was a dissent, I believe, not a concurrence. She wrote a dissent as to the majority's opinion and hence sought to affirm the holding of the trial court, and then added a paragraph stating that her opinion on the disposition of the case would be to remand it to the trial court. It was kind of a strange dissent, and the outcome of the case was ultimately remanded, and the trial court stayed the execution of the trial of the Court of Appeals' opinion pending the litigation in this court. It is certainly a confusing situation.
Well, given that situation and given our decision in Davis, what rule of law do we write here? I mean, this problem doesn't recur across the state of Ohio. This seems to be unique and factually specific to this case.
Well, Your Honor, I would...
We've got general rules on what you do to amend indictments, and we've got plenty of case law out there for courts to follow. This one seems to have gotten off track all the way through by indictment, by plea, and when it gets to the Court of Appeals, we've got three other splintered opinions. But this isn't the normal circumstance that we can write a general rule of law to correct, is it?
Your Honor, I respectfully submit that if you write a rule of law indicating that an indictment is sufficient to charge a felony of third degree, in this case, in violation of 2919.22A, if the indictment was sufficient from the beginning in this case, the amendment would have been proper, and that alleviates any problems with the Court of Appeals' decision to remand the case or not remand the case.
But you just quoted Smith, and we've already said that.
Well, Smith, yes, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals chose not to apply Smith to this case. And I believe in that instance that they were wrong. So an application of Smith to this case, a reversal of the 11th District, would again cure their splintered opinion with regard to how to dispose of this case, and again would simply reaffirm the Smith decision.
How do you see Davis impacting this case?
Davis obviously reaffirmed O'Brien, and to the extent that it stands for the proposition that an amendment cannot change the degree or identity of the offense, I would say that the question really turns on whether or not the original indictment was sufficient to charge a felony in the third degree. If the original indictment, in this case, did not charge a felony in the third degree, I believe Davis would stand for the proposition that the amendment was improper. However, in this case, the original indictment did sufficiently charge a felony in the third degree, and thus Davis really is not implicated because the name or identity of the offense was not changed.
Counsel, in your opening remarks, you asked us to protect the sanctity of the grand jury. I'm wondering what you mean by that.
Well, Your Honor, the grand jury process has the grand jury sits, as has been stated, at the intersection of the executive branch and the judicial branch, and it is somewhat of a unique process. In this case, the Court of Appeals decided that even though the grand jury returned an indictment specifying that the defendant stood accused of a felony of the third degree, the grand jury couldn't have known what the elements of RC 29.1 or 2919.22A were as a felony of the third degree. They opined that the grand jury didn't know what the elements were and thus couldn't have meant to charge that as a felony of the third degree. I would encourage this court to presume that the grand jury did act, presume they acted in regularity and knew what it was doing when it returned an indictment, knew the elements of the crime, returned an indictment specifying the crime, and thus that indictment was sufficient to charge the crime in question.
Yeah, I guess you could, one could ask the question, doesn't it protect the sanctity of the grand jury even more if we require the grand jury to make the factual finding that makes the crime here a third-degree felony rather than a misdemeanor? And there's no question. We know the jury has considered the statutory element that's required to make this a felony. There's no question. Then no one questions whether the grand jury understood what was before it or not.
Well, Your Honor, in a sense, unless the grand jury is going to be voting on every element of a crime, they vote on charges, and it must be presumed that they understand the elements of the charges. There was obviously a mistake in this case translating what was presented to the grand jury into the indictment. Our office, as a general practice, goes above and beyond what is required, and in this case, wasn't able to translate the language of the minutes into the indictment properly, but nonetheless, this indictment remains sufficient to charge the felony of the third degree. Your Honors, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you, Mr. Horsack.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Perola.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, if I may beg 15 seconds of indulgence, I'm compelled to say that today's argument is 36 and a half years after my first argument before this Court, and this is the fourth separate venue in which I've argued, and it's a grand, glorious place to be a lawyer. So excuse me for that, but I needed to say that.
Congratulations.
We like to hear that, Mr. Perola. There's nothing wrong with telling us it's a...
The first two were in the old State House, which was a grand courtroom also. Anyway, with regard to this case, this Court wrote in Cologne, quote, the state must meet its duty to properly indict a defendant, and we will not excuse the state's error at the cost of the defendant's longstanding constitutional right. I think that so much sums up the issue that really governs this case. We all know that the actual facts necessary to indict for the third-degree felony were present and probably were at the grand jury. The only reason that didn't turn out to be in the indictment is because somebody made a ministerial mistake. Somebody didn't put it where it belongs. It's not a question of not having the available evidence or a missing witness. I am certain, though we don't know, none of us could know, I am certain that they actually had that evidence, and they had an indictment returned that was inadequate to charge what they wanted to charge. And for that reason, they're in the situation that I just referred to in the colon, the opinion I just read, the requirement that is the prosecutor who controls this process. He has the crime, he has the witnesses, he has the scheduling, he has the paperwork. It is he who decides how these cases are presented and followed, which is precisely what I believe the opinion I just quoted was referring to.
Mr. Parola, if I was waiting for someone to raise the Cologne case. Normally, or before that, the idea of a charging instrument being simply to notify the defendant of what the charges were and the defenses that may be available to the individual. I mean, that's, we trial judges were always telling the juries that this is not evidence of anything, it is merely to put the defendant on notice. Would you say that Cologne has changed that position to increase the rights of the defendant with respect to what the grand jury does in charging?
Not at all. I don't think the grand jury process has changed one iota in a substance since Bain in 1880, if that's the right year, a year like that. None of that's changed. I don't think Cologne changed that a bit. I think the requirement that the facts, Wozniak says facts, the facts that are must be proved must be in the indictment. That's been historical law, and that's what's missing here. And of course, in proposition of law number one, the state wants to take the position that somehow this serious physical harm is not a fact. It is not an element. But in that, actually I shouldn't say that. I think in proposition of law number one, they say it is an element, but what they do say is it's been there all along. They say that the indictment was proper in the first place because it said at the end of the indictment, this is a felony of the third degree.
What does a felony of the third degree, how does the misdemeanor one become elevated to a felony of the third degree?
Under this statute, it's by the addition of the element of serious physical harm being suffered by the victim.
And is there another way that that could happen, or any other way?
Not that I'm aware of, ma'am. I think that that's an element that makes it a third-degree felony, and that's got to be alleged to do that.
And if it is in the indictment that there is the child endangering, it's a felony of the third degree, and there's no other way to elevate a misdemeanor one child endangering to an F3 but for serious physical harm, where's the lack of notice to the client?
It isn't a question of notice. This is not about notice, and there is notice for sure. I don't argue that at all. This is about the substantive grand jury consideration of dispositive controlling facts. And those facts are, was there serious physical harm? Of course there's notice. Every grand jury indictment's got at least two components. Notice, to be sure, and substantive accusation of a fact. And that's been the law forever. And that's what's missing in this case because, as the Court of Appeals here pointed out, there's no way to really know if the grand jury ever considered this fact. But
well,
you and
yes,
I.
Yes, there is a way to know. They elevate it to a third degree felony. They could only do that by finding serious physical harm. Otherwise, they would have returned an indictment for a misdemeanor.
The prosecutor put that on there, ma'am. There's no science. The grand jury doesn't vote on whether it's a third degree felony or not. That's a conclusion of law. And we have all recognized the fact that the
prosecutor make up conclusions of law depending on what they want, despite what a grand jury finds, or do they base it on what the grand jury tells them they find?
Well, gets me back to how I started. I'm sure it was a mistake, Your Honor. I'm sure that they really did do this, but they didn't put it in the indictment. And that's why I alluded to the Cologne quotation at the beginning, because I think I have a right to insist through.
If you read the indictment, you can only get to the third degree if you have serious physical harm. So why isn't that considered in the indictment? It seems obvious to me it is.
Because it's not a fact. It's a conclusion of law, ma'am. And a fact is totally different. A fact is suffered serious physical harm. This is a conclusion of law. The degree of a crime is not a fact. It's a conclusion of law. And it's totally irrelevant. The fact is missing. And every other case in which we've considered individualized elements, we've required that, and the conclusion at the end is not important. I've cited some cases to that effect in my brief, and also.
Well, counsel, if you look at the amendment to the indictment, and the rule is that if you don't change the name of the crime, and you don't change the degree, and therefore you don't change the penalty, and you admit this was a ministerial error, if anything, where does that leave you?
What you quoted is part of the rule, Your Honor. You didn't quote the entire rule. Certainly, name and identity does involve this. Identity is, does it change the penalty? This certainly changed the penalty from a misdemeanor to a third-degree felony. But the point is, that's only half of the equation. The other half is, did that group of nine citizens independently consider this fact? And I hearken back to Justice Rehnquist's quotation from in the Cotton case, where he talks about the significance effect. Your Honors have cited that, too. The significance of the grand jury between the citizen and the government and the police. And that's what's missing. And it's almost all much ado about nothing for the reason, not, I shouldn't say that, because this is clearly a ministerial mistake. I'm sure that they had all the evidence that they needed, but they didn't put it in the indictment. And they did the three things that I alluded to, I think, in my brief that I think cost them the upper hand in this case. The second point that they're arguing in proposition of law number two is even more. They say it in number one, it is an element and is required to be proved, and in number two, it says it doesn't have to be proved. They say it's a, I'm talking about the serious physical harm. They say it is a special finding that is not an element or a fact that needs to be required. Under that theory, you would indict for a misdemeanor and then convict for a felony. Because under their argument on proposition of law number two, you would indict for child endangering, which we all agree and know without more is a misdemeanor of the first degree. And then if the so-called special finding that they're talking about would be added on to that, that would become a felony. So you'd be convicted of a felony without ever having been indicted for a felony. And I don't think there's any justification for that under any jurisprudence that I'm aware of. I would also point out that no appellate court that I was able to find in my meager examination, probably much less than you will be doing, no appellate court deals with this as anything except an element of the crime. All over the state, some parts of the state, they treat it as a specification. They'll charge it as a misdemeanor in the indictment, and they'll add on a spec for serious physical harm.
We've done it as a special finding, though, haven't we?
That's
value in theft cases and fleeing and eluding, we've dealt with it as a special finding in those cases. And actually, the indictment here specified it was a felony of the third degree, correct?
There's language that says that. The indictment didn't say that, but the language on it said it, yes.
Okay.
I draw a distinction there, Judge.
And in Davis, we've said that if you increase the penalty or change the degree of the offense, you would alter the identity.
And
but the amendment offered here didn't change the degree of the offense.
Indeed it did, Your Honor. It made it from a misdemeanor to a felony.
Because it's your view that the indictment was a misdemeanor.
Without question.
Despite the fact that it said a felony of the third degree.
Because it was missing the critical elements that took that allegation from a misdemeanor to a felony. It was missing them, period. And there's no question that that's what it's by blue.
Your brief argues that we should dismiss this case as having been improvidently allowed.
Right.
Because it's your view, I think, that Davis adequately sets forth the law on this subject. And if we go wading into PEPCA and change something, we upset a battery of law. Would you speak about that?
I think Davis, again, is only part of the problem. Davis is historical, traditional law that any change by amendment that raises the offense in degree or penalty is an improper amendment if the grand jury didn't do it.
And if this court then says that it didn't, the amendment didn't change it, it just simply clarified to specify that the serious physical harm third degree element would be added to comport with what the indictment already specified, then Davis controls this case.
Davis controls in part because we're overlooking the fact that we're missing the grand jury consideration of the evidence. And Davis doesn't deal with that. Davis deals with the potential penalty and elevation of charge.
Well, Mr. Horacek argues that in Smith we already said that due process requires that it must be presented. So are you arguing Smith or are you arguing Davis?
No, I'm not arguing either one of those. Well, Davis, of course, controls. I win on Davis because it does exactly what Davis prohibits. But I would point out in Fairbanks, which has been alluded to without its name, and Smith, those cases involved indictments already. In those cases, the relevant facts were considered by a grand jury already, both in Smith and in Fairbanks. In this case, the relevant facts were never considered by the grand jury, and that's my problem.
Mr. Parola, I'm trying to understand for purposes of the future, if in fact, instead of the felony of the third degree, the the indictment in its body had specifically laid out all of the elements, including serious physical harm, but was missing F3, which you stated is a legal conclusion. Would that be a sufficient indictment?
Absolutely. A perfectly valid indictment charging an F3, because that's an add-on that can be done at any time. Suppose they put on there that it was an F4. Suppose they made a mistake. Suppose somebody typed it on as an F4 when it really was an F3. Nobody would challenge the fact that that could be corrected as a matter of law, because it wouldn't be an F4. It would be an F3. The example you gave would be a perfectly valid indictment, because that's a fact considered by the grand jury and contained in the document that they're calling the indictment. And there's no doubt that that's sufficient. I have no question about that.
Would you comment on the opinions that have been submitted by the appellate court in this case in terms of whether or not there is a judgment?
Almost nothing has caused me more consternation in this case than that, Your Honor. I don't know if it's a matter of internal protocol. I'm not aware of any constitutional mandate that allows or prohibits a dissenting judge on a three-judge panel to join for purposes of disposition with others who disagree with him or her. And that's what happened here. I don't know of any authority for that. And I don't think Judge O'Toole, in her concurring opinion, who brought this all to our attention, did either. If that's a procedural failing, it isn't really substantively related to my case, I don't think, because as long as the case is not disposed of like Judge O'Toole wanted it disposed of, like they should have discharged the defendant right then and there because the sentence was over at that point, and that's what Judge O'Toole thought was correct. But that's just a question of should it be sent back, or should somebody else have to send it back, or do those two judges have a right to, do you have to fight it out until you agree? I don't know that that really helps, but I think it's a distressing state of affairs.
But we have a judge who's indicated that the conviction as a felony of the third degree should be affirmed, but the matter should be remanded for sentencing as a misdemeanor, which is what's troubling me.
Myself also, Your Honor. That's an internal mechanism. I don't have any law governing that, and I can't tell you why that's either prohibited or allowed. It seems like she should have no part in that. I cavalierly alluded to that in my brief. I thought she wasn't part of that court. The definition of a court is a court here is when four of you agree on something. That's the court. That court is when two agree on something.
Counsel,
I'm sorry, Judge.
I want to follow up on Justice O'Donnell's question, and that is, if you prevail here, what is the proper disposition of the case at this point?
I think what would be left pending for you, if you affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals, would be to remand it to that court, and they will remand it to the Court of Common Pleas for sentencing, and then we would get into the whole issue of can these three remaining misdemeanors be consecutive sentences? But I think it's got to be remanded to the Court of Common Pleas for implementation of that sentence, either by you or by the Court of Appeals, if the judgment is affirmed. So I would like it to be otherwise, but I think procedurally and our history would tell us that you're not likely to take a direct action on that more likely to send it back to a lower court for implementation. That may get you right into Judge O'Donnell's question, whether or not there is a judgment back there. I mean, did enough people vote on that who had the right to vote on it? And that is a question I'm not sure I would be able to answer. I don't know the answer.
Do you perceive a dichotomy between Davis and Smith?
Yes. Without question, Davis went to the grand. Davis's case was heard by a grand jury, and Smith wasn't. And there's a big difference, if you ask me, because we're neglecting in the whole context of, name and identity of the offense. We're neglecting the grand jury consideration, and that is so important.
Does Davis need to be amended, in your view?
No, I thought Davis. Your jurisprudence, your jurisprudence in the indictment law has been excellent, with the exception of O'Brien, which is 20 years old and should be reversed. O'Brien is bad law, even though I win on O'Brien, because it did change the name and identity. O'Brien doesn't consider the grand jury at all. You add recklessness to the indictment without anybody ever considering not whether the conduct was reckless. And I think that was a big mistake. I think O'Brien should be reversed. That's all I can suggest. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Perolda. Mr. Horsack, you've saved almost 2 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Horsack, if in fact you were required to make sure that all of the elements are in the indictment. Is that going to be a, would that be a difficulty or a change in procedure in your office with respect to how you operate in the grand jury?
I know, Your Honor, I don't think that would be a change in procedure in the office. Obviously, it is our practice to include all the elements in the indictment on a regular basis. However, I think that rule of law would essentially overrule this court's decision in O'Brien, which was reaffirmed by Davis. In O'Brien, this court stated that an indictment which does not contain all the elements of an offense may be amended to include the omitted element if the name or identity of the offense is not changed. It seems to me that that rule of law was written almost specifically for this case. I mean, we have an indictment that charged Mr. Pepka with a felony of the third degree. If serious physical harm is an element and was omitted, it would seem that O'Brien would allow us to amend it and insert that omitted element.
Does the counsel, do you know, does the grand jury, the cases cited by Appellee seem to suggest that Gaither and a couple other cases, the Sixth Circuit case, seem to indicate that the conclusion, the legal conclusion, which of course that is, it's a felony of third degree, that's a legal conclusion. Who makes that conclusion? Does the prosecutor tack that onto the indictment or add that to the indictment after the jury, grand jury returns, it does, completes its work, and then the prosecutor looks at it and determines, well, this is what we'd hope for, a third degree felony. But the cases cited, and there's no U.S. Supreme Court case, not a lot of heavy, authority. But it does seem to suggest that that's not a factual finding. That's a legal conclusion by someone. Does the grand jury make that conclusion, or does the prosecutor make that conclusion?
Your Honor, it's our practice that the grand jury returns minutes which indicate that they voted on a crime, in this case RC 2919.22A, and it also indicates felony of the second degree on the minutes that they return. That is then translated into the indictment and added in that section as the RC 2919.22A, a felony of the third degree.
So the grand jury makes that conclusion to when they return the indictment?
It is our practice that they vote on the charges and the degree of the felony.
Is the grand jury testimony transcribed?
It is, Your Honor, yes. And
was there any request here for a copy of the transcript to determine what exactly the jury, grand jury voted on?
Not by the state,
particularized
Your Honor.
Under a particularized need standard?
Neither party requested it, Your Honor. The state, after the motion to amend was granted, there was never any request to see that grand jury testimony.
So we don't know how much advice the grand jurors received from the prosecutors to the impact or the consequence of their factual findings.
But no, Your Honor, but I think that there must be a presumption as prosecutors, as officers of the court, as lawyers in the state, properly advised the grand jury and the proceedings were conducted in accordance with the law.
Counsel, in this matter, I mean, talking about what happens internally in the grand jury process, there were witnesses before the grand jury.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And the witnesses presumably were the officers who investigated this crime, or the paramedics, or the responding first responders.
I mean, yeah, yes, Your Honor.
Which would give the grand jury the information that they were to consider when trying to figure out the level or the degree of the crime that was committed, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not done within a vacuum where you've got the grand jury and you've got the prosecutor. I'm presuming that there were other witnesses there.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. Obviously, the state presented evidence to the grand jury to establish this charge.
It gets us to the purpose of the indictment again. And as I mentioned, the notice of that, what is the charge, what is the degree, gives the defendant notice, and it seems like we're talking now about memorializing what was considered by the grand jury factually, which then gets into the detail of what exactly did they consider, whether it was serious physical harm, et cetera. And you're saying, if I understand it, that the practice in your office is to go through and put the name of the charge, put the type of offense, felony of the third degree, mm-hmm. and also every element within the indictment. Is that what you're saying? Every factual element as the offense is defined.
When preparing an indictment, Your Honor, we go through the facts that were presented to the grand jury, list those in the indictment, and then include the subsection, or the last paragraph indicates that it's this act, to wit, endangering children, constitutes a felony of the third degree against the peace and dignity of the state of Ohio.
So you would say that, yes, it is a memorialization of what has occurred, what the grand jury has found in a particular case?
I think that's the practice in our office, but I think the question here is not necessarily what is best practice, but what is required. And I think that in this case, the law does not require that the serious physical harm be included in the indictment in this particular statute.
If the grand, this may not then bear on the facts of this case, but if the grand jury were to conclude, take this case, these facts, grand jury were to conclude in its minutes that this is a felony of the first degree, what would the prosecutor do with that? I assume you wouldn't proceed on that.
No, Your Honor, I assume that we wouldn't proceed. I cannot tell you off the top of my head what the procedure would be, perhaps take it back to the grand jury and have them clarify that, but I can't tell you for sure what that procedure would be.
Thank you, Mr. Horzak.